Our speaker is Brother Jim Colley. This is class number two. His title, I Will Return to the Peoples, a Pure Language. The reading for this section comes from Zephaniah chapter 2 at verse 12 through chapter 3 to verse 10.
We have a big task in front of us this afternoon, brethren and sisters and young people. And for those of you who weren't here for the first session, we pass on our love and regards, which we did in the earlier session, and also just mention the fact that our series of studies is revolving around Rome. But because the lectures are revolving around Israel primarily, we're going to try and combine those two things and contrast the destiny of Israel and Rome. And this study on Zephaniah lends itself remarkably to that particular theme. Now, my problem is that I could spend a whole week on this subject and still not exhaust it. I know that's the case because we've done this as a study both at Bible schools and in Bible class, and it's taken many, many sessions to get through it. I've got to try and compress that into one session without losing you, and that's going to be my problem. Your problem will be that you'll need to really stay with me, or try and stay with me. And we'll do this by putting up some transparencies, which hopefully will assist enormously in that regard. But it's important that you try and stay with me. Now, I know what happens. You're sitting in an audience and someone makes a statement and your mind goes off somewhere else, and then if you're like me, you're charging on at 100 miles an hour, you lose the next 2 or 3 minutes and you've lost the picture. You really need to stay with me. I want you to get the big picture of this, not the detail, the big picture. You can put the details on there for yourself later on. But let me just make a wild assertion at the outset, which I'm not wont to do, but no one laughed. I'll make this wild assertion at the outset that the book of Zephaniah, which they call a minor prophet, is the biggest stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation that you'll find in the Bible. You agree with that? Nobody is nodding their head. They're all shaking their head saying, don't believe it. In an hour's time, God willing, if I'm still on my feet here, you'll believe it. Okay, now that's up to me to prove that to you, isn't it? Now this is not going to be quite so personal in terms of its message, but I think it will be as powerful in terms of the scriptures. If we can just make sense of this in the next hour or so, we will shake our heads in wonderment that it could be so, and it is so. Now, some of you have heard little bits and pieces of this over the course of the years that we've been here. We've sort of just taken a bit from here and a bit from there in other studies. But today you're going to get the platform of it and see why those other studies that we're going to talk about all play their part in this overall message. Now, the first thing we need to do, I think, is just to put Zephaniah in its context as to what he was on about, why he was sent, and therefore why the message is framed the way it is. How many of you have actually done a study of Zephaniah? Yes, one hand goes up. That's good. There's probably a few of you who have over the years. But I would suggest to you that maybe there's not too many Christadelphians that have really done a lot of work on Zephaniah. True? Why haven't we been studying the biggest stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation? It's an incredibly important book, and yet we don't put it in that category. Okay, the times of Zephaniah. Might have to come just a fraction closer, Uncle Bart. Thank you. There are two parts of this chart. If you take the clear bar lines here, that forms one bar, and then the continuation of it is down here at the bottom. Okay, so we take from the times of Isaiah the prophet up there at the top, along to Zephaniah the prophet here in the yellow, then Jeremiah, and Jeremiah continues right through to the end of the kingdom of Judah when Zedekiah was taken off into captivity, and in the year 586, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city of Jerusalem. You got the basis of the chart? Okay, all I want this chart for really is to tell you where Zephaniah comes in the scheme of things. And you'll notice that he actually begins to prophesy during the reign of Josiah.
Around about the year 630 or thereabouts, Zephaniah began his prophecy, and he was probably prophesying around about the year 626, which was 40 years from the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's important because one of the predominant phrases of Zephaniah is the phrase, the day of Yahweh. You notice that in chapter 1, we didn't read chapter 1, but if you have a look at verse 7, it says, hold thy peace at the presence of Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. Then thereafter, you will find that phrase used frequently throughout the rest of that chapter and into chapter 2 and in fact into chapter 3 as well. So the day of Yahweh is very important in the context of Zephaniah. It is his basic message. He was warning about the day of judgment. But the day of Yahweh is a phrase, of course, that is taken up by other prophets. Zechariah is one of them. Zechariah 12, 13 and 14 is full of references to in that day. And the day is the day of Yahweh. It is not one day. It's actually a time period of 40 years. It is a period of divine judgment. And that's exactly what Zephaniah was talking about. He began to prophesy in the days of Josiah, and 40 years later, Judah's judgment was complete. And God began to bring judgment upon Judah here, and he completed it after 40 years with the decimation of Jerusalem. So the day of Yahweh was upon them. It was bearing down upon them like a violent storm. And it would overwhelm them, chapter 1 says. The great day of Yahweh, verse 14, is near. It is near, and it hasteth greatly. It was pouring down upon them, as it were. It will be a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness, a day of trumpet and alarm against the fenced cities, against the high towers. Very interesting. Verse 16 of chapter 1 mentions high towers. Now, you know, when you're studying the scriptures, you've got to try and latch onto a theme. Any book, indeed any chapter, has a theme. And here it is. One of the many themes of Zephaniah, but a key theme. A reference to Yahweh's judgments upon the high towers. Who was the first tower builder? His name was Nimrod. Nimrod's name is not mentioned in Zephaniah. But apart from Yahweh himself, brethren and sisters, Nimrod dominates Zephaniah. No question about that, as we shall see. Okay, so why is it then? Why do you think that Zephaniah should have a message in respect to Nimrod, who was the son of Cush? Well, we're going to answer that question. Now look at this man's name. He was a descendant of Hezekiah of the house of David. That is, he was in the royal family. He prophesied between 630 and 621 during the early years of Josiah's reign. He was contemporary with Jeremiah, who began prophesying in Josiah's 13th year, and he was responsible for Josiah's early reforms. No doubt about that. The contents of Zephaniah chapter 1 spell out the things that God hated. And there were judgments to be brought to bear upon six things. There were six victims of divine judgment. And in each one of those cases, Josiah came along and fulfilled those prophecies. And he removed, as it were, the hideous things that had been built up in that land. Okay. Here's his message. An analysis of the prophecy. The theme is the great day of Yahweh is near. You can divide up Zephaniah into basically four sections. Chapter 1, verse 1 to 2, verse 3 is hastening judgments upon Judah. Chapter 2, verses 4 to 15 is judgment on the nations. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 7 is the sins of Judah and Jerusalem. And chapter 3, verses 8 to 20 finalizes the subject with a remnant restored and redeemed. The purpose of the prophecy is to encourage a faithful remnant in the face of rapidly approaching divine judgment. What for? Okay, there's got to be a reason for approaching divine judgment. What is it? What was the problem in Judah that brought God's judgments to bear? Well, it's a fascinating fact that this man's heritage highlights why God's judgments were bearing down upon that nation. Look at verse 1 of Zephaniah chapter 1. The word of Yahweh which came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah, as it should read, in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah. Have you ever heard of a genealogy like that amongst the prophets of God? Usually it just says Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, the priest. or it says Isaiah the son of Amos. Doesn't ever spell it out like that. But there are four generations referred to here, because you see, God wants us to know that this man is part of the royal family. And he wants us to know that it's the royal family that is the problem. Because you see, any Israelite who named his son Cush has to be a rabbit. He has to be as silly as a wheel. It'd be like me naming my son John Paul. Naming him after the Pope. You just wouldn't do it as an Israelite, would you? And we know how important naming was to the Jew. There was real significance in the selection of names amongst the Hebrews. And this king, or this member of the royal family, he wasn't king, Gedaliah, named his son Cushai, who had a son named Zephaniah. And we have in the book of Zephaniah the first of three references to Cush. And that is significant. You will never find that many references to Cush in any other part of the scripture altogether. Why should that be so? Well, I'll tell you why it's so. Who was the grandfather of Josiah? You can answer if you want. Manasseh. Who reigned for 55 long years, for the best part of which he devoted himself to the corruption of the ecclesia, the decimation of everything that had any tinge of truth about it, including the destruction of all Bibles, and anybody who stood for the Bible, and their blood flowed in the streets of Jerusalem, and in every single place prominent in the city of Jerusalem, he placed an idol to the gods of the Babylonians. He had altars to the god of the sun and to the god of the moon and the god of the stars. And he adopted the religion of Babylon. And when you went into Jerusalem in the days of Manasseh, it was like walking through Rome. You were in the Vatican. The temple was a shrine for the gods of Babylon. The ecclesia was in utter apostasy. And because of that, God said to his people, because like Manasseh, your king, whose name means causing to forget, you have forgotten me and taken the gods of Babylon to yourself, I am going to cure you of your problem by sending you to Babylon, the very home of these idolatries that you have adopted. And because you've borrowed the doctrines of Cush, I'm going to send you to the very home of Cush and all his doctrines, and you will learn to hate it. You know what happened, don't you? The Jews came out of Babylon, and they have never turned to idolatry ever since. Oh, they worship flesh, but they've never bowed down to idols. They have become a permanently monotheistic people. Why? Because God cured them of idolatry in the home of idolatry. But that's why they went there. That's why Manasseh went there, remember? He was taken into captivity by the Assyrians. Now you think about this. The record of 2 Chronicles 33 says he was taken into captivity by the Assyrians, who were not on good terms with the Babylonians at that time. You know where they took him? They didn't take him to Nineveh. Or any of the other cities of the Assyrians. You know where they took him? Babylon. And in Babylon, his heart was turned and he repented of what he'd done. And God released him and he came back and tried to undo what he'd done, but it was too late because his people hadn't gone through the same experience as him and their hearts were still in Babylon. And that's where God sent them. So when Zephaniah comes on the scene, it is in the wake of the reign of Manasseh and Amon his son, who in two short years restored all of the idolatry of his father, which Manasseh had taken down, and that nation was back in the same state as it was for 40 or more years in the reign of Manasseh. It was Cush. It was Babylon. It was the Vatican. And so God raises up Zephaniah. Now, that's the reason
why Zephaniah is an important stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation. Its whole subject is the ultimate overthrow of the great system of Babylon. Now let me just point out to you the three places where Cush occurs. It occurs in verse 1 of chapter 1 in the name Cushai, who was a descendant of Ham, the father of the dark races, Cush, the father of Nimrod. Now, what I've been saying to you is that this place, Babylon, was the source of Israel's problems at the time. There's the processional way. But over here, you see on the top right-hand side of this picture, you've got the ziggurat. Let's get a bit closer to the ziggurat. This is looking at it from the other direction. Here's the ziggurat. Now, what was that based on? Where was the origin of the ziggurat? Yeah, the Tower of Babel. Now, we're going to have to go back and have a look at that, because the brains behind the Tower of Babel was Cush. He was the brain box behind the Tower of Babel. You know why? Well, in the scriptures, you find that Cush is the thinking power of Babylon. And we'll point this out in a moment. So then, we're actually in the 11th chapter, 10th and 11th chapters of Genesis. And you'll notice a similarity in this particular drawing between the Tower of Babel and the ziggurat, because it was based upon the Tower of Babel. They were going back to their roots. And Israel, Judah, under Manasseh, had gone and taken all of that religion, its outward symbols and its doctrines, and imported it into Jerusalem. So that Jerusalem had become the apostasy, the home of the apostasy, like Rome is today. That's why God was angry. And that's why he sent Zephaniah. He was going to talk about the ultimate overthrow of this system. And that's why in each chapter you'll find reference to Cush. Now come to chapter 2. Verse 12. Verse 12 says, and this is God's judgment upon the nations, ye Ethiopians also shall be slain by my sword. Now the word Ethiopians there is Cushite. Ye Cushites. Ethiopia is the translator's interpretation of the word Cush in the Hebrew. I mean, they're not wrong in a sense, but they're not right either. So you should render that Cushites. Then you come to chapter 3, and at verse 10, you read this. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, even the daughter of my dispersed, shall bring mine offering. Now the rivers of Ethiopia are the rivers of Cush. That is, the rivers of Babylon. The rivers of Ethiopia here is a reference to the Tigris and the Euphrates. Okay, so three times in a prophecy containing only three relatively short chapters, there is a reference to Cush. That can't be by accident. It has to have something to do with the theme of the book, and it does. It's just interesting, isn't it, that we live in times, brothers and sisters and young people, when the nations, particularly the nations of Europe, are setting about the task of reconstructing the Tower of Babel. Now, this is a bit fuzzy, but it's a poster issued by the European nations. Europe, many tongues, one voice, it says down here. Now, you've probably all seen this before, I'm sure. It's issued by the European nations as they unite around Catholicism, and they've gone back to the symbology of the Tower of Babel. And in fact, they have in mind to actually build the Tower of Babel. They had these towering ambitions. It is proposed to build the world's tallest building in Brussels over the Berlaymont building, which you can see down here, the current headquarters of the EE, well, not called the EEC anymore, it's called the EU. The headquarters of the European community is the Berlaymont building, which happens to be in the shape of a cross, twisted cross. And they're going to build, they propose to build this tower, which will be the world's tallest building. Now, most of you would know the CN Tower in Toronto. There it is there. It's about half the height of the proposed tower that they want to build over the Berlaymont building.
So they want to rebuild the Tower of Babel because it symbolises many nations, one voice. Now, isn't that interesting? Because the Tower of Babel saw them building a representation of their rebellion against God. And they were all of one voice or one tongue, and so God confused their voice. And they're going to reverse that, they reckon. Bring them all back together again. Now, isn't that interesting in the context of what we're going to be considering here in the prophecy of Zephaniah? But a bit more about Cush. Cush in the scriptures. Now, here are his titles. He is, as I've said several times, the great original prophet of the Babylonian mysteries. He has several titles in the Bible. And again, you need to just tuck these away because, as I said to you, when you think of Cush, think of Catholicism. Well, one of his titles was Bel. Bel means the confounder. And, of course, it comes from the origins of Babylon, the confounding of the languages of men. His symbol was a club. In Chaldean, it equals to break in pieces and to scatter abroad. That is, confound something by smashing it and spreading it with a club. And there are several references there as to the origins of this idea. One of the other titles of Cush was Nebo. Now, Nebo was one of the gods of Babylon, from whence you have names like Nebuchadnezzar, which means Nebo, defend the boundary. And there are other names like that, you know, like Nebuzaradan and Nebu something else. They're all based on that god Nebo. There's another one which I just can't think of. The other title of Cush is Molech. Molech means king. It's the same, though, as the god Bel. When people refer to Molech, they referred to the original Babylonian god Bel. One of the other titles of Cush was Mercury or Hermes, which is his Egyptian title, meaning son of Ham. Okay, so you read all these titles in the prophets in particular, and you think, well, what on earth is this all about? Like Jeremiah 50 and 51. Well, actually, it's all going back right to the very origin of the religion of Babylon. Going back to Cush, he was the brain power behind Nimrod. It's a little bit like Micah chapter 6, verse 16, which says that the statutes of Omri are kept and all the works of the house of Ahab. What's that telling you? Well, it's saying that Omri was the statute maker, he was the thinker, he was the doctrinaire leadership of Israel, but Ahab was the doer. Ahab was the one who actually implemented the thinking of his father. Statutes of Omri are kept and all the works of the house of Ahab. You like saying the statutes of Cush are kept and all the works of the house of Nimrod and his wife Semiramis, who had a lot to do with the building up of the structure of the Catholic system. So then, I hope that by now we've sort of set at least the foundations of where Zephaniah is coming from. And we need just now, I think, to go back and have a look at Nimrod. Let's go back to the origins of this man. Back to Genesis chapter 10. Now, I'm not sure I haven't done some of this over here. Anyway, like I said, you usually forget what people say after a few weeks, so I'm probably on safe ground. Here is Nimrod. In Genesis 10 and at verse 8 we read, amongst the sons of Ham, Cush begat Nimrod. His name means rebel, or we will rebel. Now that is the spirit of this man. We will rebel. He happens to be the 13th generation from Adam in the line of Cain. And 13 is unquestionably the number of rebellion. In places like Genesis 14, verse 4, it says that they served Chedorlaomer for 12 years, and in the 13th, they rebelled. No one tell me that 13 is not the age of rebellion. I happen to have
four children who've all attained or almost attained the age of 13. And it is remarkable that when they get to that turn between 12 and 13, how they reach out to do their own thing, which usually involves rebelling against the word of mum or dad. It just happens to be the age of rebellion. So that he was the 13th from Adam. And he was going to rebel. Why would he rebel? Well, he happens to have a father who was his brain box, who gave him all the ideas, who laid down the doctrines, the principles by which Nimrod would operate. And so he began to be a mighty one in the earth. The word is Gibor, means a warrior. And his success was based upon his physical prowess in the conquering of both men and animals. And in verse 9 it says he was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Now it's not saying that Yahweh appreciated this man's hunting. It's not saying that God recognized him as a champion. It's saying that he was doing it in defiance of Yahweh. Because the word before there is pani, it means in the face. And he did this in the face of Yahweh. And you'll remember that when they rebelled, they went westwards. They went eastwards. Whereas Abraham went westwards, they went eastwards. Which was in the face of the rising sun. It was a challenge. So here was a man who was going to conduct a rebellion. Wherefore he gained this notoriety. It is said in verse 9, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, in the face of Yahweh. So he had international notoriety. Everybody knew that this man was challenging Yahweh. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babylon, Babel, confusion, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar, the enemy's tooth. And out of that land he went forth into Assyria. That's how it should read. My margin says that. Yours may not, but that's how it should read. He went forth after the confusion of the tongues at Babylon, and he went into Assyria and builded Nineveh, which means the place of habitation, and the city Rehoboth and Calah. Now this man Nimrod gained his power and his notoriety by his prowess, and he built the first kingdom among men. In fact, he was the founder of the kingdom of men. Now listen to Brother Thomas. Not Brother Thomas just yet. We've got a quote from him in a moment. Let's just take Alexander Hislop first of all. And we'll follow through this idea of prowess in the killing of men and beasts. Hislop says this in The Two Babylons, page 23. The way too in which Ninus, the legendary first Assyrian king, and this is being drawn from the legends of Assyria, gained his power is the very way in which Nimrod erected his. There can be no doubt that it was by inuring, that is, hardening his followers to the toils and dangers of the chase, that he gradually formed them to the use of arms and so prepared them for aiding him in establishing his dominions. Now, it's a fact of history, of course, that that was the case, that Assyrian kings obtained and cemented their power among men by their prowess in hunting. This is one of the pieces of stone wallpaper, as it were, which was taken from the palaces of the Assyrian kings. It can now be found in the British Museum in London. And I've actually seen this particular frieze, they call it, of the Assyrian kings. Now you'll notice a lot of dead lions around here. Okay, and they're all stuck with pins. And they're being fired from the bow and arrow of the Assyrian king, who is portraying himself here as a mighty hunter. And where did he get that from? Well, he got it from the first king of Babylon, who then went out and built the kingdom of Assyria. They were mighty hunters before Yahweh. Now, why would they be that? Well, what was the point of all this? On what basis did Nimrod decide, or Cush decide for him, that the way to secure the allegiance of men was to go out and be a mighty hunter? Well, I'll show you why. Genesis chapter 9. When eight people came forth from the ark, this is what God said to them. Genesis 9, verse 2. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. In other words, when God had decimated flesh on the earth, got rid of all unrighteousness and preserved only one family, he let them out of the ark and he said, I've given you dominion. But your dominion over the beasts of the earth depends upon maintaining your dominion over carnality in yourself. If you decide to give up the truth, and there's only Christadelphians alive now upon the earth, you decide to let the flesh reign in your mortal body, I'll take your dominion away. And of course, the obvious corollary to that is, if your dominion is taken away, the beasts of the earth who will be frightened of you will actually get the better of you. You will lose your dominion, and the beasts of the earth will rise up against you. Now, this was a problem in those times. Remember when Israel came in the land, God said, drive the Canaanites out, but do it little by little, because if you do it all at once, the wild beasts of the earth will rise up against you. So you see, man, who decided, under the leadership of men like Cush and Nimrod, that they were going to rebel against God, had a problem. And their problem was that the wild animals were rising up against them. So Nimrod established his power by building cities and becoming a mighty hunter. And as he went forth in his chariot, putting lions to death, the people said, he's God. He can do what God said he would do for Noah's family. God was going to give us dominion, protection from the animals. Nimrod's done it. And they bowed down to him as a god. And he became the first God king amongst men. God king of the kingdom of men. Now that's why, and here's the quote from Brother Thomas, that's why it's so important to go back to Nimrod. This is from Eureka Volume 4, page 225, the Logos edition. And it says this, first, and it's in the context of the image of Nebuchadnezzar, first the lion of Babylon, or the golden section of the image. Then the bear of Medo-Persia, or the silver. Third, the leopard of Grecia, or the brazen. And fourth, the dragon of Rome, or the iron. Okay, up till now, isn't it? It's all ABC. These are the four general phases of the kingdom of men. From the time of Nimrod to the future coming of the Ancient of Days to supersede it by the kingdom of God. Now, Brother Thomas, of course, was very astute, and he knew that the image that was revealed to Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2 was not only about Nebuchadnezzar and the kings and the empires that were to follow him. It had its roots in the kingdom of Nimrod, the first king among men. And he traced it right back there. So I guess what we're doing is laying some foundations. And the foundations are important, because when you come to Genesis chapter 11, this is what occurred. Just so that we can see with clarity the next step, Genesis 11 is about the rebellion of Nimrod, which leads to the confusion of man's tongue. Genesis 11 verse 1 says, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Now this word language in the Hebrew is Sapha, S-A-H-P-H-A-H, Sapha. It means a lip, or the lip, by implication therefore a language. And there are five occurrences of the word here in this context. Okay, so God had given men one language, one lip. Now, do you think it just means that they all spoke the same language, which might have been ancient Hebrew, which was God's tongue? Do you think that? Well, yes. That's one of the primary senses of this, that they all spoke the same language. They could understand each other. All of us here speak English. Therefore, we can understand each other. What would be the point of me standing up here speaking in Italian?
I mean, there may be someone who understands Italian, but not many of you would. Be no point. For you to understand me, I've got to speak in English. You see, so there's a higher meaning to it than just all speaking the same tongue. And here is another principle of interpretation. When you read they were all of one language, it's actually saying when they came out of the ark and multiplied, they all had the same religion. That's what the singular tongue represented. It represented the same religion. Because when they came out of the ark, they all did have the same religion, and for many years that was the case. But that all changed when Nimrod decided to rebel. And if you're going to rebel against a religion, what have you got to do? You've got to create a new religion. New doctrines. And that's exactly what Cush did. He created some new doctrines, like the immortality of the soul, like fiery hell judgments, like the mother and child, like the triune Godhead, and so on. All of those things had their origins way back in the days of Nimrod. So you see what's happening here? This is not just a simple matter of rebelling against God. It's a matter of changing the world's religion. It came to pass, verse 2, that as they journeyed, not from the east, there, that should be, as they journeyed east, as the Revised Version puts it, they went into the face of the sun. They challenged the rising of light. This was an open and direct challenge against God. So what did they do? Well, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, the enemy's tooth, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, let's make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime or tar they had for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a shem. That's what the word is in the Hebrew. Let us make us a shem, a name or an appellation, which would set us apart. Let's make a name for ourselves, they're saying, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now, they were worried that if they started a new religion, and they got away from the foundations of truth, that they would be scattered. Just look at the world today. How many religions are there? There are more than the hairs on your head. I can't say the hairs on my head because there wouldn't be enough. More than the hairs on your head. There are religions in multiplicity all over the earth. All sorts of isms. How's that happened? Well, men have been left to themselves. They've got away from the foundations, and anything is possible. And so Nimrod says, we've got to get these people together. We're going to change God's religion. We're going to have another religion. And so he built a tower to symbolize their unity based upon the doctrines that were taught to him by Cush, his father. The same doctrines that form the foundations of the apostasy today. Okay, see why it is so important to establish these things as a basis for Zephaniah. And so what happens, of course, is that Yahweh came down, he saw their activity, and he said in verse 6, behold, the people is one, and they have all one lip. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down and confound their lip, that they may not understand one another's speech. So Yahweh scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Now, how many nations came out of this incident? This is just to see if you're all still awake. And give me a chance to have a break.
And I haven't got enough hairs on my head.
What was that, Peter?
There's only enough hairs on the ones called all the
Well, not today there isn't. But how many nations actually came out of this rebellion and this division of the nations? 70. How do we know that? It's in chapter 10. In chapter 10, which actually gives us the dividing of the nations, which came out of the rebellion of Nimrod, there are 70 nations referred to.
Now, verse 1 says, now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and these are the sons, the sons or progeny that came from those three boys. In verses 2 to 5, the sons of Japheth are mentioned, and there are 14 of them. Now, there were many more sons of Japheth than 14. But they're the ones that God nominates. And there's a purpose behind all this, as you'll see in a moment. A very real purpose. There were 14 nations from Japheth. In verses 6 to 20, there were 30 nations from Ham. Ham was the father of the dark races. Out of him came Canaan. See that in verse 6? Sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, which is Egypt, Phut, and Canaan. It's very interesting. The origins of all that stands for the flesh comes from this man. In verses 21 to 32, 26 nations came from Shem. Now, they were not by any means all the progeny that came out of Shem's loins. But God just puts 26 there. And if you add them up, 14, 30 and 26, in simple arithmetic, it comes to 70. Okay, so here the Bible is telling us that men who started with one lip or one religion ended up, because of rebellion and changing the doctrinal basis of the truth, ended up as 70 separate nations who could not understand each other. Well, of course, you might say, well, didn't the sons of Shem understand it? Well, of course they did. They could speak to each other because if they were born of Shem, they understood the language of Shem. But what it's telling us, brothers and sisters and young people, is that when you lift this to a higher level, what God is saying here is that when he divided the peoples of the earth and they went off every which way, even though many of them could continue to communicate with each other, he looked down upon that and he said, well, I see 70 nations. You got that? Whatever the true situation was, God said, there are 70 nations. And they represent the community of mankind separated from me. Now that's a very important principle, as we shall see. Over and over again, reference is made to 70. Right through the law, through the prophets, and into the New Testament. So it's a very important principle. Now, if you want to tackle this, and there will be some here who will take on the challenge to find 70 nations in Genesis chapter 10, then you need to count the names only once. Don't count any names twice. And omit Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth from the list, and the names of any cities that are mentioned. And you'll get 70. No question about it, because I've done it. And it's exactly right. Okay. We got those foundations. Now let's go back to the book of Zephaniah. Remember my rather bold statement that Zephaniah is the biggest stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation? Here the Bible is telling us that men who started with one lip or one religion ended up, because of rebellion and changing the doctrinal basis of the truth, ended up as 70 separate nations who could not understand each other. Well, of course, you might say, well, didn't the sons of Shem understand it? Well, of course they did. They could speak to each other because if they were born of Shem, they understood the language of Shem. But what it's telling us, brothers and sisters and young people, is that when you lift this to a higher level, what God is saying here is that when he divided the peoples of the earth and they went off every which way, even though many of them could continue to communicate with each other, he looked down upon that and he said, well, I see 70 nations. You got that? Whatever the true situation was, God said, there are 70 nations. And they represent the community of mankind separated from me. Now that's a very important principle, as we shall see. Over and over again, reference is made to 70. Right through the law, through the prophets, and into the New Testament. So it's a very important principle. Now, if you want to tackle this, and there will be some here who will take on the challenge to find 70 nations in Genesis chapter 10, then you need to count the names only once. Don't count any names twice. And omit Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth from the list, and the names of any cities that are mentioned. And you'll get 70. No question about it, because I've done it. And it's exactly right. Okay.
We got those foundations. Now let's go back to the book of Zephaniah. Remember my rather bold statement that Zephaniah is the biggest stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation? Where's Zephaniah? After, yeah, oh, I've got it now, Habakkuk. Okay, let me just read to you from verse 12 of chapter 2. Ye Ethiopian, ye Cushites also, ye shall be slain by my sword. And he will stretch out his hand against the north. Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Where did you think Ethiopia was? South. Not what it says here. Okay. You've got to read carefully, don't you? Every time you read Ethiopia, your mind goes south. Not here. Says, he shall stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria. So he's part of the Cushite family. And why not? Cush was the father of Nimrod. Nimrod firstly built Babylon. Then he removed and built Assyria. And Nineveh was his capital. That's why it then says, and he will make Nineveh a desolation and dry like a wilderness. And flocks shall lie down in the midst of her. Look at the next phrase. And all the beasts of the earth. What did Nimrod do with beasts? He kept them out of the city and he killed them because it symbolized his power. And they worshipped him because of it. They called him a god. Because he could do for them what Yahweh promised he could do for Noah. He could exercise dominion over the beasts of the earth. God says, when I'm finished with you, Nimrod, Nineveh will be a desolation and the beasts will lie down in it. And they'll control your city. See what he's saying? See how important it is to get the roots? And not those roots, you've got no hope of understanding what's in here. When you've got the roots, it opens the whole picture up. And it goes on to talk about the beasts lying down and so on. In verse 15 it says, it shall become a desolation and a place for beasts to lie down in. Everyone that passeth by shall hiss and wag his hand in dismissal of this place that was the home and the seat of the power of a man who got and maintained his power by killing beasts. He was a mighty hunter in the face of Yahweh. He wasn't just interested in getting the control of beasts. He wanted control of men's minds. And he got that too. And he came to represent the great system amongst men, brethren and sisters, that has devoted its whole existence to the grasping of the control of men's mind. Man's mind, I should say. And millions of people have been held in thraldom by that Catholic system because they have exercised their dominion over men through the religion of Cush. That's why God hates it. And that's why he has vowed to destroy it. And so what God intends to do is to unwind and to totally reverse the work of Nimrod. And that's what chapter 3, verses 8, 9 and 10 of this book is all about. Now we'll come back to the first seven verses very briefly if time permits, but just cast your eye at verse 6 of Zephaniah chapter 3. Isn't this language pregnant with meaning in the context of what we've just said? I have cut off the nations. Their towers are desolate. Need I say any more? Their towers are desolate. And the first tower built was the tower of rebellion against divine religion. Result? Confusion of the tongues of men. Okay, let's come to Zephaniah 3 verse 8. Zephaniah 3 verse 8 is about Armageddon and the subsequent battles over 40 years to destroy the invader of the land, the Gogian host, and his compatriots, the Catholic system of Europe, which will give him support. Again, it's a bold statement, but how do I know that's true?
Let's just read the verse. Therefore, wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day. What day? Isn't it the same day that he's been referring to in chapter 1? The great day of Yahweh is near. The day of Yahweh is a day of wrath. It's a day of trouble, of distress, of wasteness, desolation, darkness. It's a day of the trumpet and of alarm against the fenced cities and against the high towers. It's the day of Zechariah chapter 14, which is a day of 40 years. The period of divine judgment upon the nations. No question that Zephaniah 3 verse 8 is about that day. Now this is a very curious verse. Have a look at it. The verse contains every letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which the lexicographers say is a remarkable feature. I mean, if I ask you to construct a sentence having every letter of the English alphabet, what would you say? Well, you would use the one that they use to teach people typing. The quick brown fox jumped over... No. Yeah. Jumped over the lazy dog. All right? And there's every letter of the English language. But what does it mean? I mean, who cares whether the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog? But this verse is absolutely jam-packed full of meaning. And when God recorded this one sentence in his word, and this is just one sentence, in that one sentence he put every single letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and there are 22 of them, including what are called the five final letters. Now in the Hebrew alphabet you've got 22 basic letters, we've got 26 in English. Of those 22, there are five of them which have what I call a final letter, which is used at the end of words. You don't use the ordinary letter, you use the final letter. And if you look at that, 22 plus 5 is 27. These 27 letters of the alphabet are used at least once in the verse. 27 is an interesting number in itself. 3 times 9, or put scripturally, 999, which happens to be the reverse of, as it were, if you turned upside down, what would you get? You can see it, can't you? So God is doing something here. What's he doing? He's reversing everything Nimrod did. And it'll take him 40 years to do it. It's the stamp of certainty. 9 is the number of fullness and finality. And what God is saying is, I am determined to undo everything Nimrod did. Got that message? I'll put every word of my tongue in that verse so you will know absolutely that I am determined. Look what he says. Therefore, wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh. That word wait, chakar in the Hebrew, means to adhere to, therefore to wait. And brethren, sisters and young people, if we ever needed an exhortation, it is that. Waiting in this modern age with all its distractions and evils is not an easy thing. How do I know? I don't find it easy. The world with all its glitter, all its bright lights, all its entertainments is barraging us, and particularly our young people, and I'm bringing up teenagers. And I don't find waiting easy. But God says, now listen here. You wait for me because I am determined. You ever thought about it like that? Can you see a God sitting in heaven, looking down upon an earth with a look of determination in his face? That I am going to turn upside down everything that Nimrod's done? Never lose sight of that, brethren and sisters and young people. Never lose sight of the importance of the apocalypse and therefore of the interpretation of Brother Thomas in Eureka, which has stood the test of time and will be proven correct. All of this nonsense about the apostasy being Israel is just a whole heap of rubbish. The whole Bible is full of Babylon.
And here is a huge stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation. If you've got the modern interpretation of Revelation, you have not got Buckley's charts. I mean, sorry, that's an Australian saying. You've got no chance of understanding the Bible. We've got to keep our head where it ought to be, in the sound expositions of our pioneering brethren. And I wouldn't be standing here saying these things to you if it wasn't for them. So here's God's determination. What is it? You read it with me. See if you can read Nimrod in this. Wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey. Now, isn't that interesting? Who was the first man to become a god by rising up to the prey? Nimrod. What did it achieve? The division of the nations. From being people with one tongue to being a multiplicity. What does God say? Until I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations. That's the opposite, the scatter. That I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. Now think about that for a while. Ever thought about that, brethren, sisters and young people? God is jealous. He's a jealous God. Not in the kind of jealousy that human nature is capable of producing. His jealousy is pure. And you think he looks down upon the world as we see it, with all these multiplicity of religions, led by the Catholic system that have got the minds of billions of people in thraldom. They're blackened out. They can't see a thing. And they're destined to destruction because of it. You think God's not jealous about that? He hates the fact that the multitude of mankind is locked up in that thraldom, and he's determined to release them. Even all the fire of my jealousy. What a wonderful verse that is. But then it's followed by verse 9, which should be read with it. Because it's the next sentence. For then will I turn to the peoples, and I would ask you to add an S to the end of the word people. People can be a plural word by itself, but just make sure of it. In the Hebrew, it's plural. For then will I return, as the word turn should be rendered, I will return to the peoples a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent. The word consent is the Hebrew word Shechem. Shoulder. They might all serve him with one shoulder. Now, I've got 10 minutes. I'm going to take you on a very hectic ride. You ready? I know you're all exhausted mentally. No, Peter says, you're not okay, good, because I need to grab you for the next 10 minutes. What's this verse all about? Well, you can see, can't you, what he's saying in the context of Nimrod, who's there, and the contrasts are made between Yahweh and Nimrod in this prophecy, whereas Nimrod, who represents the papacy, is there as a mighty warrior. Yahweh represents himself in Zephaniah 3:17, through Christ as a mighty warrior. Whereas Nimrod's there as a king from Genesis 10, verse 10. Yahweh's there as king in verse 15 of chapter 3. Look at it. Yahweh hath taken away thy judgments. The king of Israel has said. Whereas Nimrod's there as a hunter in Genesis 10, verse 9. Yahweh's there in verse 8 of chapter 3, as we've seen, as a hunter, until I rise up to the prey. Whereas Nimrod made for himself a name in Genesis 11, verse 4. Yahweh's going to make Israel a name. It will be his name in Zephaniah 3, 12, 19, and 20. And the same word Shem is used, by the way. Genesis 11, verse 9, the language is confused. But Yahweh's going to give to the peoples a pure language, which means he's going to give them a pure religion. Now, of course, when we read this normally, we say, oh, yes, in the kingdom, when men come up to worship in the house of God, they'll all have the same tongue. Of course they will eventually. They'll all speak God's language in the kingdom age. But that's not what it's about. This is about giving them the same religion.
They're all going to believe the same things and worship the same God. That's going to be a pure language. And it's the same word used in Genesis 11, Safar, a pure lip. Okay, you got the contrasts? Well, you come back with me to Genesis chapter 10. Remember my words about 70 nations being in Genesis 10? Well, 70 is the number of the Gentiles, or the number of the nations. 12 is the number of Israel. We all agree with that? No problem with that. So that when Israel came to Elam in the wilderness, Exodus 15:27, they found in Elam, which means the place of the mighty ones, a cameo of the kingdom. And there were 12 wells of water from which 70 palm trees took their nourishment. There's Israel and the kingdom, and the nations deriving their nourishment from Israel. Simple, isn't it? Luke chapter 9, when Christ sent forth his disciples two by two, he sent 12 initially, because if you read Luke chapter 9, you will find its context is about Israel. But in Luke chapter 10, he sent out 70. Why? Well, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. Right, so you've got Israel first, and then the nations. In Revelation 7, we read that perfect Israel is described as the 12 tribes. Or later on, as 144,000, 12 by 12. That's the perfect Israel. But where do they come from? They're redeemed out of every nation and tongue. And you know what they're carrying in their hands in Revelation 7 and verse 9? Palm branches. Because the palm is the symbol of the Gentiles. So you see, we're not plucking things out of the air here, brethren and sisters, and sort of saying, well, this just suits the case. This is a biblical process of interpretation. That being the case, maybe it might be wise just to rip you out of Genesis 10 for the time being. No? Yeah, I will. Deuteronomy 32, verse 8. I've done this before here too, I'm sure, but we just need to go back over it. 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy in verse 8. Let's squeeze on that thinking cap now. Because I haven't got time to go into the surrounding context. I've just got to direct your attention to verse 8. Which says, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, just pause there, what's he talking about? When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, when did that happen? Genesis 10, isn't it? So in your margin, you should have Genesis 10. And if you think that that's not right, look at your margin. It says Genesis 11, verse 8. Okay? So it's not my ideas. Other people have seen this as well. So Deuteronomy 32, verse 8, is about the division of the nations at the time of Nimrod. You got that? Full stop. That's it. No argument. Then he says, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. How many sons did Jacob have? Come on, you've got to think. I'm not going to go on until you do. 12. So how many nations were there in Genesis 10? 70. So the wheels have fallen off, haven't they? We've got a real problem. No, we haven't. Oh yes, Jacob's family was initially 12, wasn't it? 12 sons came the 12 tribes. But when Jacob came into Egypt, leaving out the sons or the progeny of Jacob in Egypt, how many were there?
70.
70.
Okay, you got that? God's method is to work from Israel as a basis to the nations, 70. And if you don't think this is right, just hang on. It is right. Now, come back to Genesis chapter 10. And to verse 21. Here's the family of Shem. In verse 21 it says, "And unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber." Well, of course he was the father of all the children of Shem. But why does it say he was the father of all the children of Eber? You ever ask yourself that question? Where does Eber come in the list? Well, here's the list. Eber is number 11. Now, this is the family tree of Shem. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it, that there are some people missing here. Elam, he's got no children listed. Ash has got none listed. Lud's got none listed. But Aram has. He's got four. Now, why would God just pick these people? I mean, is he just plucking them out of the air? Of course he's not. So he's not giving us the full picture. He doesn't want us to see the full picture. He just wants us to see this. So he chooses to run the line down Arphaxad. So there's Shem, got all these sons, but through Arphaxad you've got Salah, who's number 10 in the list, that is, listed off number 10 in the order, and Eber, number 11. Now, verse 21 begins by saying that Shem is the father of all the children of Eber. Why not the father of all the children of Arphaxad? Ever thought about that? Now, isn't that curious? There's got to be a reason, doesn't there? There's always a reason. Eber is the same as Hebrew. It's the root of Hebrew. So the statement is that Shem was the father of all the children of the Hebrews, and Hebrews were crosses over. People who were prepared to get out of one order of things and to come into the truth. Which is what Abraham did. And when God called Abraham, where did he call him from? Ur of the Chaldees.
God called a man out of all the Chaldees and said, "Hey, you, cross over the river and become the first Hebrew." And in Genesis chapter 14, that's exactly what he's called. Abram the Hebrew. Shem is the father of all the family of the Hebrews. Eber is number 11. And out of Eber comes two boys. Have a look at verse 25. "And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg." The name actually means an earthquake or a division. "Because in his days the earth was divided." That is, in his days, the division of chapter 11, when God divided to the nations their inheritance, occurred. Now, he was number 12 in the list. And the division of the nations into 70 occurred in the days of Peleg, in the days of number 12. Isn't that curious? Remember the principle? First Israel, then the Gentiles. 12, 70. Okay, where do we go from here? The end of verse 25 says, "And his brother's name was Joktan." Now, Joktan is number 13 in the list. He's down here. You know how many sons he had? 13. His name means, "He will be made little." He has 13 sons. Do you know what the numerical value of Joktan is? It's 169, which happens to be 13 times 13. And he's got 13 sons. Their numerical value taken together is 2,756, which happens to be 112 times 13. What's it saying? It was in the days of number 12 that Nimrod rebelled. And because of it, God scattered the nations and they became 70. Joktan and his progeny represent the nations in rebellion. That's why 13 is stamped all over him. Now this principle is held short. And look at this. It's a bit of a fairy transparency, but it'll do the job. Look at the family of Abraham. From Shem to Jacob, there were 12 patriarchs. You count Shem and then the children down to Jacob, there are 12 of them. Isaac is number 11, so he'd line up next door to Peleg, okay, as it were. He has two sons, just like Eber had two sons. Sorry, I shouldn't have said Peleg, I should have said, I don't want to confuse you here, Eber. He lines up against Eber. Eber has two sons, Peleg and Joktan. So Isaac has two sons. Jacob, who became the true firstborn, had 12 sons, became Israel. Esau, who was the firstborn, but through rebellion, ended up becoming a type of the nations. And in Genesis 36, brethren and sisters and young people, the progeny of Esau is listed. Guess how many are listed? I'll give you one guess. If you're wrong, you go to the back of the class. 70. That ain't no accident. Okay, so the principle holds true. I'm not sort of, again, trying to pull all over your eyes. It's there. Okay, let's come back quickly to Zephaniah and finish this off. And I'll draw upon your memory here. I know you're flagging. It's almost time for tea, and Uncle Bart will be saying, when are you going to put it on, Marlene? Just give me a couple of minutes. Zephaniah chapter 3, it says in verse 9, "For then I will turn to the peoples a pure lip, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent, one Shechem." When God called Abraham, he called him alone, says Isaiah 51 verse 2. Abram became not the lofty or exalted father, which his name meant. He became Abraham, the father of many nations. So God started with one man and ended up with many nations. He was the father of Israel, 12, ended up drawing in 70. Got that? What was the first place that Abram, the Hebrew, the crosser over, came to in the land that's recorded? Shechem. What was the second place? Bethel. What did he do at Shechem and Bethel? He built an altar at Shechem. And when he got to Bethel, to the house of God, because he had to make some choices at Shechem, in the land for the first time, he had to make a choice as to which direction to go. He went to the house of God. When he got to the house of God, there was a choice to be made between Bethel and Hur. Hur, it isn't it? Means ruin. So there was the house of God and there was ruin. And the record says in Genesis 12 that when he got to Bethel, he called upon the name of Yahweh. Now Shechem means to shoulder. So the choice he had to make at Shechem was to shoulder or accept responsibility. When he got to Bethel, he had to make a choice between ruin and the house of God, the ecclesia. And when he'd made that choice, he called upon the name of Yahweh. There's a process there, isn't there? Read the verse again. Verse 9. "For then will I return to the peoples a pure lip, a pure religion, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one Shechem, shoulder." Isn't that interesting? God's done the same with Israel, hasn't he?
you only of all the families of the earth have I known, he said to them. Like Abraham, he called them alone. The people shall dwell alone, said Balaam, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. They were a separate people, but what did God call them for? Well, for the same reason he called Abram. Through Abram, he's going to make a family of many nations. And through Israel, he's going to make a family of nations. So God's intention was that he might draw all nations through Israel into one family. And he illustrated this so beautifully in the Feast of Tabernacles. It was celebrated in the seventh month at the time when the whole harvest had been drawn in. What did they do over the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, they killed, amongst other things, 70 bullocks. On day one it was, oh, isn't that interesting? On day one, they killed 13, the number of rebellion. And they went down progressively. Day two was 12, day three was 11, day four, 10, day five, 9, day six, 8, day seven, last day, 7, the number of Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant. We went from rebellion to Abraham. And God, in the wake of the rebellion of Nimrod, said, you think you've finished me off, haven't you? I'll take one man out of Ur of the Chaldees, and when I'm finished with him, I'll have many nations in one family. Just one nation. You've got 1,000 years to go yet? Complete that work? Which is why in the kingdom age, the nations will still be separate nations, will come up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles throughout the millennium. But at the end of the millennium, guess what? There'll only be one nation. And that's why on the 8th day of this feast, it was a separate day, but it was attached to it. It was the last holy convocation in Israel's religious year. They offered just one bullock. 70. 14 plus 12 plus 11 plus 10 plus 9 plus 8 plus 7 is 70. But on the 8th day, which represents the time beyond the millennium, they offered just one. Because there will only be one nation, and its name will be Israel. And the whole process will begin like this. It will begin with the second Exodus, when, as verse 10 says in Zephaniah 3, from beyond the rivers of Cush, my suppliants, and he means Israel, even the daughter of my dispersed shall bring mine offering. And so from beyond the rivers of Babylon shall come Israel, his people, under the leadership of Elijah, and they will cross over and become Hebrews. And they will come into the land and be accepted and become the nucleus of God's kingdom. And then for 1,000 years, the nations will be drawn progressively into that one nation. And when God's finished, he will have brought all peoples from the 70 back into one. Isn't that interesting? And I will return to the peoples a pure language, because I'm determined to reverse everything that Nimrod did.